Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate y'all taking time for another edition of Midrats. And today we're going to hit on a subject that should be kind of fun because one of the subjects of the article in question that we'll use as a kickoff has been a repeat guest here at Midrats. But we want to address something that not only for those that are seeped in the American, lack of a better phrase, the American context of the relationship between the senior leaders in the military and their political masters, but also where those lines are and how you best navigate them correctly. You have to look at how do we maintain enough distance from politicians and the politics of the day and retain our independence while also at the same time being under the control of the civilian leaders. Is there a point where while using the uniform and carrying out your duties, you no longer become just the good soldier but become part of the political process as well? And our guest today to discuss this and more will be J.D. Gordon, Commander, United States Navy, retired. And kind of as a touching off point for today's episode will be an article that he wrote recently titled Obama's Top Military Advisors, Useful Idiots or Good Military Officers. You can find a link to that article at the show page or over on our home blogs. If you haven't had a chance to read it, go ahead and click on it. That'll give you kind of a preview of some of the areas we'll be touching on. J.D., he was a career Navy public affairs officer with over two decades of active duty service. He is a former Defense Department spokesman for the Western Hemisphere, which is where the name may ring a bell for many of you. In the office of the Secretary of Defense, he served both under Secretary Don Rumsfeld and Robert Gates between 2005 and 2009. He also was an advisor to the Vice President Communications and Chief Foreign Policy and National Security Advisor to the former Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain. Also during the 2010 congressional campaign, he arranged speaking events for former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Recently, he has been a senior fellow and communications advisor to numerous think tanks and foundations. He also appears occasionally on Fox News and Washington Times since 2010. He also is a regular commenter on national security and foreign policy in television and radio outlets in both English and Spanish language. J.D., welcome to Midrats.
Nice to be on your show.
Perfect. Thought as an opener here, get a chance for the listeners to get a view on what brought you to write the article you did. I thought it was very timely because you saw usually as an aside to other conversations and occasional news stories, but more often than not, in one-to-one conversations, people who either are serving or were serving are a lot of times social media. During the ISIS campaign, usually when people are looking at issues that are going on at the higher levels, unless you've done a tour at the strategic level or the operational level, you can kind of scratch your head about some differences. But I thought what was interesting about the conversation with ISIS and the efforts we've been making recently against them, there's a lot of people who only worked at the tactical level were seeing senior leaderships talking at the tactical level, and we're starting to ask questions about, you know, what exactly was going on. And so just wanted to get the listeners a foundation on what brought you to the point you decided to weigh in and talk about what was going on with the discussions of senior leadership in relation to what is in a political election season that's coming up on Tuesday. Everything is political.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, you know, I really owe it to Senator McCain. Basically, he sparked the idea in my head to write a column like this. It's for Fox News, Fox News Opinion, where I've been a contributing columnist since 2010. And that is that Senator McCain called Admiral Kirby an idiot. He was on a North Carolina radio interview, Senator McCain was, and he had been saying that ISIL's winning the war, that the airstrikes clearly aren't sufficient, et cetera. And basically John Kirby was asked at the podium at the Pentagon, well, what do you think? What do you say? Senator McCain says, we're not winning the war against ISIL. They're winning. What do you say? And then it took several minutes for John Kirby to come up with a response. He didn't answer it, and there was a lot of hemming and hawing type of thing. And so anyway, Senator McCain says, well, this idiot Admiral Kirby, and then he said, you got to play it. You got to play it, as the senator was on this North Carolina radio interview talking about this idiot Admiral Kirby. And that ended up becoming a relatively big news story. It was in the Washington Post, in the Hill, Politico, certainly a big inside the Beltway story. It was definitely a big story in Washington. And so I'm a former Pentagon spokesman, as you mentioned in the intro. And also John Kirby's been a friend of mine for 15 years, and he's a great Navy officer. So when I first heard it, I thought, ouch, that hurts. It strikes close to home. But then I thought about it a few more minutes. I'm like, well, you know what? I'm cringing every week because of something John Kirby's been saying there as the Pentagon press secretary. He knows he can't be telling the American people the whole unvarnished truth. What he tells the American people, things like it was a good idea to trade five top Taliban leaders at Guantanamo for an army deserter. And it didn't matter that Bo Bergdahl, the army deserter, disappeared off post on his own in Afghanistan. It didn't matter. The circumstances didn't matter. I can't believe John Kirby would stand up there and tell the American people that these $1 trillion in defense cuts are justified. $1 trillion in defense cuts. That's going to hollow out the military like during the 1970s. We're not even going to be able to defend this nation. You got John Kirby up there standing up there in front of the podium, representing Secretary Hagel, representing the president, saying these things are a good idea. He can't even say whether the Islamic State is Islamic or not, because that's the party line. So at what point do military officers become useful idiots of an administration that's actually doing a great deal of harm to national security, or are they good officers? Are they just following orders? And so that's why I wanted to write the column, and I also wrote one on the Hill, similar themes, about that debate needs to be happening in the United States. Are officers like John Kirby or General Dempsey, General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, are they useful idiots for President Obama as he's taking a wrecking ball to the military and they're justifying it, standing up there in the uniform, or are they just good officers following orders? That's the debate I think we should have, Sal.
Well, one of the questions, J.D., is and we've had Admiral Kirby on the show a couple of times. One of the questions I asked him was, at what point does a public affairs officer who is, in his case, a spokesman for the Department of Defense, you know, isn't there a danger that you're co-opted by your client so much that you become, as you've said, I don't want to say useful idiot, but you become a shill for their point of view. And what is his option? I mean, what would you, if you were in his shoes, what option does he have to in his job? Quit or keep doing his job as he sees it?
He's got two, and I was similarly in his shoes. I was a Navy commander, which is lower than the rank he had when I was there, and I was a spokesman for the Western Hemisphere. So we worked in the same office. He wasn't there at the time when I was there. I was there 2005 to 2009. But, you know, I could have been in a very similar position, too, had I been misleading the American people on a daily basis, but I wasn't. I was working during the Bush administration, and frankly, my last 9 months, I retired at 20 years, so I had to do my last 9 months in the military in the Pentagon under President Obama's first term. The first 9 months of his term were my last 9 months before I can retire. And you know what? I wasn't much of a great spokesman at the time for him. I was more like a telephone switchboard operator. Well, you got to call the White House. So call State Department, call Justice Department, call Southcom in Miami, call Joint Task Force Guantanamo, because I just refused to say the things that I knew weren't true. And John Kirby, unfortunately, is a part of this effort. You know, I think it's very important to notice that a Navy public affairs officer, the highest you go typically, and I was a PAO I had a 20-year career, the highest you go typically is a one-star admiral, CHINFO, the Chief of Navy Information. John was that. He deliberately accepted a promotion, was offered one to two stars, which is unprecedented to have a two-star Navy public affairs officer be the chief heading out spokesman. That's unprecedented. That's never happened. So John is getting this $160,000 salary a year with housing allowances about $200,000 a year, probably for about a three-year tour, to really be part and parcel of the Obama administration's spin of this country. So John's got two options, in my view. He could resign, which I think would be a good idea if he did, but he could also challenge his bosses. You know, his direct boss isn't Secretary Hagel. His direct boss is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs, a young guy named Brent Colburn. Now, Brent Colburn is the equivalent of a four-star general, being an Assistant Secretary of Defense. Brent Colburn was President Obama's communications director during the 2012 campaign. So these aren't John Kirby's ideas necessarily. He's the messenger. But why doesn't Brent Colburn, a relatively young guy, political operative, why doesn't he get out from behind Kirby's uniform and get to the podium and stop putting John Kirby in this position? John's an honorable guy, but not doing the country any favors, and he's not doing his professional reputation any favors either. But this is partially Brent Colburn's fault, Secretary Hagel's fault. They're throwing John out there and hiding behind his uniform, and that in Old Navy lingo is unsat.
It is one thing that – and I actually kind of like Admiral Kirby, mostly because he's come on my show twice, and we had great long conversations with him. He has some good team, but I also was caught not flat-footed, but a little surprised at how much he has been thrown out there. And a lot of the positions that he's been put in, and he's been the happy warrior, if nothing else, up there, taking the slings and arrow. What made me uncomfortable about it was he was answering questions, and I thought put in a context that would have been better served by somebody wearing a coat and tie, not somebody in uniform. And I think part of that might be, and I wanted to get your opinion of this, one of the concerns I've always had with good people putting tough jobs, or at least interesting jobs, in Washington, D.C. on back-to-back tours. I get up to D.C. a couple of times a year, and I kind of joke with the people that I mentioned there that I'm just a lower official from the provinces coming to Rome to beseech the emperor for certain items. D.C. area is a different – it didn't used to be this way. In the 80s, it wasn't, that's for sure. It's very different than the rest of the country, completely disconnected in income, style, almost neo-feudal in a few ways. All you have to do is go out to dinner with people to see that. And too many tours in D.C., I think you can quickly become somebody who's not in D.C., but somebody that is of D.C. and will pick up that ethos, pick up those habits, and kind of forget where you came from. Have you seen an increase, or has it always been with us, of people who are just maybe spending one tour or two tours too long in D.C., not enough time in the fleet or overseas, and is that perhaps adjusting people's perspective on what their job is and how they carry it out?
I think you're right. I think that's a big part of it. You know, John Kirby's been in Washington, I believe, consecutively since 2005, because at the time I was the director of Navy plans right before I went down to the Secretary of Defense's office. I was in the Secretary of Navy's office, and I was director of plans, and John was the spokesman for Admiral Mullen. They were in Europe. Admiral Mullen was the chief of our naval forces in Europe. And so they came over from Naples, I believe, in 2005. So John's been here ever since, because remember, Admiral Mullen became the CNO and then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so John was with Admiral Mullen for, well, since 2000. When I first started work with John, we worked together to keep our training range in Vieques. John was the second fleet PAO working for Admiral Mullen. So I've known him and Admiral Mullen many years, and very hard workers, patriots. But basically Admiral Mullen, and I think John's the same way, will do anything the political bosses want. That's why I think Admiral Mullen didn't do the country any favors either for this ARB investigation for Benghazi. You know, he was calling people in the State Department, tipping them off to things that they shouldn't have known about for the people he was investigating. So Admiral Mullen clearly hasn't, in my opinion, hasn't done the country any favors in a lot of ways, too. I mean, he's covered for Obama any way he can. And so John, I think, is cut from the same cloth. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, You know, some of this doesn't shock me as much, but I'm older than you guys, and I happen to remember the 5 o'clock follies from the Vietnam War, when military spokesmen were put in difficult positions of presenting information they either didn't completely understand or didn't know, or maybe wasn't really accurate. And it struck me that all of this, as you said earlier, why isn't there a civilian face on the Department of Defense spokes as a Department of Defense spokesperson for these briefings that go on? Is it just they like having the uniform out there because it gives them credibility, or it gives them top cover? What's your view of that?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at the polls in the United States about the most trusted institutions, the military is always near the top. Something like 70%, 80% of Americans trust the military. Congress is something like 10% or less. If you look at President Obama, his poll ratings today are about 40%, job approval rating, and foreign policy is 35%. So you could translate that down to Secretary Hagel. Maybe 35, 40% of the people trust Secretary Hagel or the politicals running this country. But if you look at a uniformed officer, you know, 80% of the people are going to believe him. So it's a no-brainer from President Obama's position, from Secretary Hagel's position. They're basically throwing John out there so they could hide behind his uniform. And John's a willing participant. Like I said, he took that promotion, special promotion to two-star. He's willingly deceiving the American people on a daily basis about some of these the train wrecks happening to the military. The military is being gutted right now. I mean, there's no question about it. And John's a willing participant in basically spinning the American people.
Well, I was wanted to back up a little bit here. Often you learn your behavior from your mentors. And I'd like to talk about Admiral Mullen for a minute, because you mentioned something that I think was spot on. The role that he had in that dog's breakfast of a State Department Benghazi investigation, I think anybody involved in that should be embarrassed with themselves. But the next part I'm saying, I was somebody that supported the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell since I was a JO. So this has really got nothing to do with that specific incident. But I thought Admiral Mullen's behavior and the words that he chose during that internal debate for Don't Ask, Don't Tell was way, way over the line into politics. And I think if you were looking for a poster child about how somebody is doing it wrong and has gone over the line, I think Mike Mullen is character number one in that parade. But I think also, and I would be interested to hear some names from you, I have a couple of mine in my mind, mostly Marines, that irrespective of subject at hand, just in general, what senior officers at the four-star level have you seen in the last decade that you think got it right, that understood what their constitutional role was and were able to avoid the seduction of being part of D.C. as opposed to somebody who's just working in D.C. and walked away from that position pretty much unbesmirched by the exposure at that level?
I'll give you two great examples, and that's an excellent question, by the way, because there are some generals and admirals that really do get it right. One's General Conway, who was a commandant of the Marine Corps. He was, before he retired the last few months, he was basically defying the administration about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell issue. He was not afraid to stand up to it, you know, and he retired. He didn't get in trouble. And now I see him from time to time in the Fox News green room. He makes the think tank rounds, and he's a patriot. He didn't buckle into the political pressure. And another one's on active duty right now, General Ray Odierno, who's the chief of staff of the Army. It was General Odierno's idea to have this quarantine on the Army troops coming back from West Africa. Secretary Hagel didn't like that because that's counter to Barack Obama's idea of the quarantine. But then Secretary Hagel got put in a difficult position. Well, do I back my military commander, who happens to be right, by the way, or do I back the White House? And Hagel caved in. He backed General Odierno, because it would have been a big sting. So General Odierno, number two, this spring when the budget cuts necessitated that the A-10 be scrapped, General Odierno was testified on the Hill, and he tried his best to help keep save the A-10. He said that, and I wrote a column about it, he said that the troops can hear it. They can see it. There's no substitute. When you get rid of the A-10, we don't have another close attack aircraft in the Air Force. The F-16 is just not a suitable replacement for those A-10s. And, you know, we could see the results of that in Syria. I mean, if we had A-10s, it would be a different ballgame against ISIL there. So General Yaron was a patriot, too, and he got it right. So those are two examples, General Conway and General James Conway and General Ray Odierno.
Well, is General Dempsey giving General Odierno any top cover for his position on this? I was going to raise the bull issue with you anyway, but is there top cover being provided? Is this kind of the beginning of the split where we get some guys looking out for the best interest, in your view, of the military as opposed to the best interest of the administration?
Yeah, I think so. I think that General Dempsey's been very willing to toe the party line, if you will, for whatever President Obama wants. For the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, it's harder than for somebody like Admiral Kirby, because the Chairman's – there's an actual billet for the Chairman. We know we have to have one. He's going to be in a tough spot under an administration that's taking a wrecking ball to the military. That's harder. John's is not as hard of a decision. I mean, he took a special promotion for that specific job. So I think a guy like John should either resign or go to his bosses and say, look, this really isn't fair. You know, I'm happy to help you with strategic communications, but, you know, you guys ought to get out in front of the podium, Mr. Colburn, Assistant Secretary Colburn or Secretary Hagel, or have some of these other political appointees that are wearing suits and ties at the Pentagon, you know, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, folks like that, Undersecretary of Defense for Intel, you guys get out to the podium once a week and start briefing. I think that's entirely appropriate.
I think there's a visual issue with this as well, and I kind of want to direct this and help you explain to a lot of our listeners are not from the U.S. We have regular listeners from Canada. I see our Turkish contingent is with us in the chat room. We have a few Dutch, Belgians, Germans, and also Brits that listen to us. And there's that phrase from Clausewitz that, you know, war is just politics by another means. But Clausewitz was a Prussian. Prussia was not a state with an army, but an army with a state. And I think that is the opposite side of the coin from where we are as a representative republic, one that was, you know, founded on a high suspicion of standing military, but we seem to have quite a one right now. In the American context, where you have, if what was going on right now, and you've seen it, over in Europe, the spokesmen are civilians, while in America, it's in uniform. In the American context of being a nation with a military, what type of precedence does this set where we consistently have people in uniform in front of the camera, vice civilians? And have we seen this in our history? Is this unprecedented, or does this go in cycles? For instance, can you think of a time where we had not necessarily professional POs like Admiral Kirby, but other people in uniform that high profile prior to retirement?
Well, I think that we have seen a couple times where we have had Pentagon spokesmen in uniform, the chief spokesman. I was in 20 years, and during that career, I started off as a SWO, surface warfare officer, doing amphibious warfare, and went into public affairs a couple years after that when I got my surface warfare pin. But I think in that time, I've also seen a one-star Craig Quigley, or Admiral Craig Quigley, who during 2003 was the Pentagon press secretary for maybe about a year or less, and then he got moved down to Tampa. This was during 2003, during the Iraq War. And then Tori Clark, basically, she was the assistant secretary, then she started briefing. There was, in the 90s, Captain Doubleday, I believe he briefed quite often at the podium. He was a Navy captain. But the reason John's is unprecedented is because he's a two-star admiral and the chief Pentagon spokesman. Now, when I was there, like I said, I was a commander. And I was quoted in the New York Times and Washington Post every week. And the biggest thing going on in the Western Hemisphere for the Defense Department was Guantanamo. So that's where I really got a lot of press attention. And some people, you know, accuse me of being window dressing for President Bush and being, you know, a shill for President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld and Secretary Gates. Here's the difference. I believe President Bush, Secretary Rumsfeld, and Secretary Gates were actively working to strengthen U.S. national security, to strengthen U.S. foreign policy. So I didn't agree with everything that I was tasked to say You know, the public affairs officers don't make the policy. We can help shape the policy at meetings, and we certainly do. But at the end of the day, whatever the policy is, the spokesman's got to articulate. I didn't agree with everything, but I knew that on balance, Secretary Rumsfeld, Secretary Gates, and the Assistant Secretary of Defense, my boss, who assigned my FITREP, the three different politicals there, starting with Larry Derrida, who was a regular briefing the media at the podium, I knew that they really wanted and were trying to strengthen U.S. national security. How can anybody possibly say that about Barack Obama and Secretary Hagel? That's the difference between what I did and what John Kirby's doing today.
Well, let's take the other side of the argument, or argue devil's advocate side. If you're a senior officer in the military under the Obama presidency, and you see that perceive that it's being, you know, military is being weakened in a lot of things, do you stay on and fight, you know, arguing that if I'm not here, Lord knows what's going to happen. I'm going to stay and save the programs I can. We're going to keep as much as we can until we until there's an electoral change. Or do you resign and protest at some point and say this has just gone too far? Is there an argument can be made that a lot of these guys are hanging in and fighting for what they believe in as well as they can under the circumstances they find themselves in?
Absolutely. But I would put a guy like another friend and colleague for many years, former boss, Rear Admiral John Greenert. He's out of the CNO, Admiral Greenert, 4-star. I mean, he's just trying to do the best he can to save the Navy. But he's not asked to get out in front of the American people once a week for the whole cameras nationwide and tell people things that aren't true or that are deliberately misleading. John Kirby's been asked to do that, and he's doing it willingly. So there's a big difference between the CNO, Admiral Greenert, who's trying to save the Navy to the best of his abilities, and a guy like John Kirby, who took a special promotion to mislead the American people, essentially, and to have Secretary Hagel and Assistant Secretary Colburn hide behind his Navy whites.
I think we've all done things when we're wearing the uniform that we aren't too proud of. Two things that come to mind to me personally is things I participated in. I thought things that I did for the Haitian embargo in the 1990s was immoral, but I did it because it wasn't illegal. And I wasn't too happy with some of the what's the euphemistic way of putting this? Some of the targets we serviced during Desert Fox simply because we could. I wasn't too happy with myself and my involvement in that, but I did it anyway. If whether it's Kirby or anybody else, I don't want to personalize too much on him because I think what we really have is an institutional vice a person issue here. But as officers of any rank, where do you draw that line between what you're being ordered to do perhaps is legal, but perhaps is unethical? And is there such thing as a minor unethical thing or a major unethical thing? And what are some of the resources or options people can tap into if they find themselves in a circumstance where they're looking to the left and they're looking to the right? Nobody else seems to be bothered with what they're doing, and they reach that point that they have two voices in their head. One voice told them, get along and go along, and the other one tells you something's just not right. What are some of the options that officers have if they reach those type of quandaries? For instance, a PAO who's being thrown in front of somebody, and it's not illegal to do what he's doing. What guideposts or resources they have to perhaps get a handhold and a reference point to where they're going?
Well, through the fleet, they certainly have the chain of command they could go to and talk to their bosses about it. And if that doesn't work, they have the inspector general. They can always make a hotline complaint out in the fleet. But John's way above that. I mean, he's at the top echelon of the government. I mean, he's in the inner circle of Secretary Hagel. That's above and beyond that. He can't call any IG about, hey, misleading the American people about the Taliban releasing the deputy minister of intel, the deputy minister of defense, two governors, and another top official for a deserter, and I'm going to tell the American people that it's the right thing to do. I mean, there's really nobody John could go to for that. So in that case, he would be better served by saying, Secretary Hagel, maybe Assistant Secretary Coburn could let the American people know that. And if he doesn't want to do that, then that's the time that he could resign. If I was John, frankly, I'd have a hard time sleeping at night. And this is not personal against John. This is a one-off. John's position is different. It's not like, you know, you may have done things in your career you didn't like to do. You did them anyway. I had things to do in my career I didn't like to do either. I did them, of course. But we weren't at that level of what John Kirby's being asked to do right now. I was close to that. It's very similar in the Pentagon. But I believed generally that the Bush administration, like I said, was trying to put American security first. It's impossible to reach that same conclusion for President Obama with these $1 trillion in defense cuts and this obsession with closing Guantanamo and releasing as many al-Qaeda and Taliban terrorists as possible when nearly 30% have gone back to terrorism and killed Americans. So, I mean, you really can't justify what John's doing. I don't think anybody really can. I think he tries to do it. Secretary Hagel will try to do it, but it's unjustifiable.
Yeah, one of the issues in your article that caught my attention was the impatience of the American people and in particular instance Senator McCain in dealing with what we all know is going to be a long struggle with ISIS, and how much we seem to place a demand on the Pentagon for instant answers to every issue that pops up, even though those people who are familiar with how long it takes to get logistics flow going, how long it takes to get bodies in the field, and all that stuff, you know, have to say we can't answer your, or should say, we can't answer your question right now. You know, this stuff is still under study, whatever the answer would be. But there seems to be a level of impatience from the media, from our political bosses in the Congress, and I'm wondering how much that drives the responses do we really need to give instant answers, or would it be acceptable for a Pentagon spokesman to say, I don't know, we're looking at that and we'll get back to you? I mean, or is that what really torqued McCain off when he called Mr. Admiral Kirby a useful idiot or whatever?
Yeah, call him an idiot. He said this idiot, Admiral Kirby. I think that Senator McCain just expressed the frustration that I have, essentially, but I hadn't said it before. I hadn't written it. I hadn't said it. I had thought it, but I hadn't said it. I hadn't articulated it. So once Senator McCain called him an idiot, and the reason he did that is because Kirby couldn't answer the question at the podium, the Pentagon podium, when he was asked by a Pentagon reporter, what do you say about Senator McCain's comments that ISIL's winning? And then Kirby had a very long-winded kind of non-answer, and he hemmed and hawed quite a bit, and it was very inarticulate. But he was probably pretty nervous to answer the question. It's a tough question, and you don't want to get on Senator McCain's bad side. A lot of guys who get on his bad side end up having to resign because Senator McCain knows how to put pressure on people. So I think John just took his time and unfortunately didn't come out well. But I think that there is an impatience in this country, but I think it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that just airstrikes is not going to defeat ISIL anyway. And meanwhile, we're at risk for another 9/11. As long as this terror group holds a country that's the size of the state of Indiana, and they're conducting genocide against groups like Christians, Yazidis, and other Muslims standing in their way, we're at risk for more 9/11s. And so there's got to be a sense of urgency. So, you know, you can't expect instant gratification, but I think Senator McCain's right. You have to have a sense of urgency, and the American people shouldn't have to be misled, especially by a guy in uniform. It is unfair.
I think, as you know, having spent some time as a recidivist staff weenie like myself and time in D.C., a one-star and a two-star from the fleet looks pretty senior, but in many places in D.C., that's the guy that gets the extra coffee. And he may be
right.
A two-star, but there's some three and some four-stars above him that could provide some peer counseling if they felt he was going in the wrong direction. And there's a three-star right now that, as I believe a major wrote a book I think almost everybody is familiar with, H.R. McMaster in Dereliction of Duty. And there's a great quote from the that I think outlined the book pretty well in the review over at Amazon, and I'm just going to do a little bit of extended quote here from the review and get your comment on it about how that translates to what we're seeing right now. Here's the quote. McMaster stresses two elements in his discussion of America's failure in Vietnam, the hubris of Johnson and advisors, and the weakness of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Dereliction of duty provides both a thorough exploration of the military's role in determining Vietnam policy and telling portrait of the men most responsible, unquote. Especially when you look at the very disjointed effort and relook at Iraq over the course of the last fiscal quarter. The critique of H.R. McMaster's on the civilian and senior military leadership during Vietnam, how much of that critique translates to the group that we have right now?
I think it's a fair question. I do think that military officers should have mentorship from senior ones where folks go astray. You would hope that there are mentors out there or peers, even other fellow folks of the same exact rank, to try to set them straight. But, you know, I just don't really see that happening so much for Admiral Kirby's position because he has the ear of Secretary Hagel, and everybody knows Secretary Hagel's political. And it's very easy to get fired in the military today. You know, I had a column for the Washington Times last November. It was called Obama's Military Purge. And I talked about how the purge is really amazing today. There are some 200 senior officers in the military that have been fired under this administration, admirals, generals, captains, colonels, the most under any presidential administration since World War II, when most people were fired for battlefield ineffectiveness. We've only had a handful of guys fired for battlefield ineffectiveness. But any type of rumor, innuendo, whatever it is, IG complaint, call, they get fired. One guy got fired for fake poker chips, Vice Admiral Tim Giardina. So it's very easy to get fired in the military these days. And so I think that the officers would be very slow to want to even raise the issue with Admiral Kirby, knowing he has Secretary Hagel's ear and he travels with him. So, you know, it would almost be like a fool's errand for a three-star or a four-star to single out Johnson, hey, you know, can you step into my office? I mean, that would be an easy way for them to get chill in the door for whatever reason Secretary Hagel or his underlings want to make up.
Yeah, you've done a pretty good job of laying out your opinion of the difference between this administration and the administrations that you saw when you were in the Pentagon. One of the questions I have is how much of what your perception of going on is going on is a perception of a difference in perception of what the goals of the military are. I mean, this is really a purely political question, it seems to me, that, and I'm not going to defend the president, but I will say that I can see a point of view that says, you know, the military got bloated. We got used to having a whole bunch of money to spend. We got toys didn't necessarily need, or if we thought we needed them, we spent a lot more money on them than we needed to have. And, you know, and there's also the question of whether or not the big, quote, imperial footprint we had was making people mad at us. You know, there's an argument that we made that some of those perceptions, and again, this is a political issue, not a necessarily a military issue, but some of those perceptions were what was causing the difficulties we were having with people like Al-Qaeda and you know, they were using those footprints and all that stuff to raise ire against us and cause us some problems. Now, if you took that point of view, and again, it's a political point of view, how do we, in the military, at the levels, and I'm talking above Admiral Kirby, I'm talking about the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all that, how are these guys going to deal with issues like that may be a fundamental difference in perception of the way the world, you know, their worldview? Do they keep hanging on and fighting for their, if it's different than what the president has, did they fight for their view? Or is it a question of him putting the people in place that share his worldview politically so that he can get what he thinks he needs out of the military? And isn't this a fundamental question of why we have elections?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point. Yeah, we do have elections. The American people elected Barack Obama. If you're a career military officer, I don't think you ever would imagine being a cadet or a midshipman, a junior officer, and then one day helping to take a wrecking ball of the military. And I agree that the military is bloated and there is a waste to cut. I mean, look, before 9/11, we had 650,000 DoD civilians. Now it's 800,000, and you can't get rid of them because public sector unions. That is such a drain on the force, those extra DoD civilians, 150,000 more you can't get rid of. That's a big problem. But the thing is, with a guy like John Kirby or General Dempsey now, how could you look the American people in the eye and say, well, President Obama broke the law, admittedly, about Bo Bergdahl's prisoner swap, didn't go to Congress like he was required. How could you justify that to the American people? That's the tip of the iceberg. It's the whole world. How could you justify just the airstrikes is sufficient? I mean, there are so many things in the Pentagon. People know that just airstrikes, air power alone, is not going to be sufficient to defeat ISIL. So there are just it just continues. The only thing I think John would have in his defense is I agree with you. If you take that worldview that, well, if the United States wasn't so powerful, Al-Qaeda wouldn't attack us. But look, we got out of Iraq, and what happened? An Al-Qaeda affiliated group took over a third of Iraq and a third of Syria. And so I think that when we do withdraw, that power vacuum is just filled by the bad guys anyway. So that's a bankrupt worldview, I would say.
I'm going to ask you to do a little speculation here. I know that's always dangerous, but it can be entertaining. But I think you're in a good position to at least outline a plausible reason for it. One of the more bizarre events in the last few months that I've watched, and I actually watched part of it live, and when it was overdone because I was distracted doing work, I said, you know, I think I just must have missed something. So I found it online, and I watched it again and was even more discombobulated after watching it. But President Obama's recent press conference, not press conference, statement on the Ebola issue and the statements coming out about why the U.S. military has a certain quarantine plan while the U.S. government has its plan for all civilians. And then we also find out that the president has decided to treat DOD civilians versus DOD uniformed like the virus cares what your ID card said. But it really gave the impression, and this is what hit me the second time I watched it without distractions, It's obvious that we have a demonstration of a commander-in-chief who cannot bend his uniform military to his will on this particular issue. That's not insignificant, and this is an insignificant issue, that you have something as clear as that, that a commander-in-chief cannot bend his military to his will. What is
not always.
Yeah, not always. But in this particular case, and again, I'm asking you to speculate, you know, how do we reach that point where something becomes that open and that obvious? What are the markers, dare I say, the red lines that people in the uniform military had to have put down in order to, the president didn't paint himself into that box. The military walled him into that box. How did we get to that point, do you think?
Well, because the one patriot, like I mentioned, General Ray Odierno, the chief of staff of the Army, that was his policy, and that was something that Secretary Hagel didn't like because it ran counter to the White House philosophy on these quarantines and on travel restrictions and everything. So it took a very brave guy. I think that General Odierno risked his career, frankly, to do it. And that's not often, though. That's like a one-off. In general, President Obama can bend the military to his will, and he is. So I'd say the Ebola thing is kind of a one-off. I'm glad that General Odierno took that stand. I'm glad that Secretary Hagel backed him. I think it's the right thing to do. But I don't think that's common. It's not typical.
You know, usually when an administration is falling apart, you get all these side-channel conversations going on, if you will. And I noticed that the news has suddenly popped up that a lot of the military decisions are not being directed necessarily by the president, that Secretary of State Kerry and that Secretary Hagel are not necessarily the in crowd with the president, that a lot of these things seem to be driven by some other advisors, including, I guess, Susan Rice and some of these folks. Is that just a perception thing? I mean, how does that stuff play when you're a PAO in the Pentagon? Is that going to be addressed at some point, or is that just kind of, you know, the normal chatter that goes on as an administration begins to wallow its way through its last term?
No, I think that's a lot of administrations. I mean, the only two that I have visibility over, of course, being the Bush administration for 3 years and 3 months in the Secretary of Defense's office, you know, going to the White House quite regularly for meetings, and State Department quite frequently, and working in the interagency pretty regularly with DOJ, CIA as well. And then the first 9 months of the Obama administration, where frankly I never went over one time, and I wasn't invited over one time. So that's before I was political. That's when I was a Navy commander. I think that the Obama administration, those folks kind of, they think they know it all. That was my perspective during the 9 months I overlapped with them. President Obama is the smartest guy in the room, I think he thinks, and he brought in people like that. So they don't want to listen to anybody. And so I think that's why it's top down, and it's very ideological from the White House.
What are your thoughts? We saw back in 2008 during the election, we saw a lot of very recently retired military officers, and even before then, actually ran for office. Admiral Sestak, perfect example, Rear Admiral Sestak, not Vice Admiral, which I like to point out to everybody, was one example. He ran for office and then left. But you had a long, long list of people who came out during that election cycle. And we also had what I called it the repeat October surprise disappointment. I still have a lot of admiration for General Powell, but I thought his statements in 2008 and 2012, where he popped up like a prairie dog, said his mantra and disappeared again, I think was beneath him, but he did anyway. And everybody makes their decisions for the reasons they make it. But it's okay when you take off the uniform to go political and be political. Has there been a period of time that it was as obvious as it was in especially the 08 election, where you had so many recently retired military people inject themselves into a national election? It was a little bit less in 2012, but I was really having trouble thinking of any time since Curtis LeMay was a vice presidential candidate that we really saw that much overt politics by retired four stars.
I think it had to do with the direction of the country, and of course Iraq was a very tough war, and we were involved in Afghanistan at the same time. So I think a lot of guys got involved in it, and I think that frankly the Obama administration was looking for kind of that military top cover, even though guys weren't in uniform anymore. But they picked guys like General Jones for the NSC, Admiral Blair to head the National Intelligence, another four-star, General Sincheki, another four-star to head the Veterans Department. So I think that the Obama administration was very quick to try to get retired admirals and generals. They got Lieutenant General Chip Gregson, retired from the Marines for the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia Pacific, and then General Clapper too. He was a Lieutenant General in the Air Force, and they made him a political essentially. And he's there now at DNI. So I think the Obama administration was really quick to jump on the bandwagon to try to get military officers. General Petraeus is another one. Another four-star. But if you look at some of the things these guys have said, General Jones said things that didn't square with reality when he was head of NSC as far as the safety and security of the country and the direction of the country and closing Guantanamo and releasing all these Taliban and al-Qaeda detainees. If you look at General Clapper saying in front of Congress that the Muslim Brotherhood is largely secular, it's almost like, are you crazy? Are you kidding me? Who handed you that brief? And so these guys are willing to do whatever they can to stay in those positions of power. It's really disappointing to me.
If the military decided that they really wanted to get a different story out, and let's say they focused on, something inconsequential like our ability to fight wars, and have the equipment to fight wars, and, in a variety of contexts, if we're not directly facing a near peer competitor at the present time, although there may be one looming on the horizon. Can they change the direction of some of this conversation so that, for example, with the A-10, could they raise, we would do a lot better in our air war if we had some A-10s. I mean, can they shift the conversation through a public affairs effort at all?
I think General Odierno tried that, and he tried his best, you know, even with Hill testimony. But, you know, it's like swimming upstream. I think once the administration decided to take a lot of these actions and a lot of these budget cuts, frankly, my understanding is the Air Force wanted to get rid of the A-10 because they wanted to focus on other priorities. But, you know, this whole thing with sequestration, too, I got a briefing from the House Armed Services Committee, since I'm a television commentator, they wanted to give me a kind of a one-on-one, and they gave me a lot of documents, and they showed me that if sequestration goes a distance, together with the Budget Control Act of 2011, we have about 280 ships in the Navy today. You know how many ships we would have at the end of that decade if the sequestration went the distance? 230. Air Force aircraft, 5,000 we've got right now. You know how many we go down to? 4,000. And so that's why I think the die is already cast. It's like fighting City Hall or swimming upstream. I mean, military officers, they can only do so much to push back against the, you know, the inevitable juggernaut from the White House. The White House is the boss. And so that's why it's that much disheartening to see guys, you know, like John Kirby and General Dempsey carry their water for him, especially a guy that doesn't have to be there. John Kirby does not have to be there. He took a special promotion to do that. General Dempsey's a little different because there's one chairman, he's the chairman, you know, you're supposed to, I wish he'd push back a little more, but, you know, it's a valid actual billet that's been there forever. John's is not. John's is, that's a different case.
Kind of from the folder of things you can control, things you can't control. You know, as somebody who, after he got his SWOP in, went off to be a PAO, you know, we have I run into him a couple times a year, great group of people. But the lieutenant commander type PAOs out there, the job they're doing right now, how has that changed since you were a lieutenant commander PAO? And also, what are you seeing how they're doing in the fleet, the job that they do, the responsibilities they have, may have changed the most, in either direction or in quantity? And there are a few of them that are very active in social media. What are the potential dangers of that, and also some of the pluses that you see out there for PAOs personally getting involved in especially social media?
I think there are pros and cons. I think it definitely helps amplify the message, but they've got to remember that anything they put on social media is a press release. I mean, I consider my Facebook page and Twitter account as mini press releases every single time, and so unless you're willing to live with it that way, you shouldn't post it. So it's a little dangerous, too, because people have opinions, and a lot of times if you're active duty in the military, it's not really very good to have an opinion unless it supports or it has totally nothing to do at all with your job. And so I think it's dangerous. But, you know, I don't – other than the social media piece, I really don't think there's much of a difference for when I was a lieutenant or lieutenant JG or lieutenant commander than what the PAOs in the field are doing now. I think it's pretty much the same. I mean, some of them may be in a little bit more difficult position to defend what the administration's doing. But down at the tactical and operational level, I don't think there's much of a difference than what I had to do with.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you're involved in now. What you've got your own firm, I gather. What kind of information are you dealing with, and what are you we're going to see from you in the next few months?
Well, I'm a senior fellow at a couple different think tanks, the Center for Secure Free Society in Washington, and also the America's Forum. I'm going on two speaking tours in Europe the next month. Well, actually, now this month in November. For 2 weeks, I go to Hungary, Austria, and Slovakia. On a lecture circuit, I'll be talking about the end of the Cold War 25th anniversary. I'll be meeting Lech Walesa, the Polish Solidarity leader. He's getting an award at the Hungarian Parliament. And then in December, I'll go to Finland to speak at the Institute of International Affairs in Helsinki, and then visit Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. A friend of mine is a defense minister from Latvia. We were on a panel together this summer in Georgia, in Batumi, at the Georgia Defense and Security Conference. So as a think tank senior fellow, I've got to know a number of active heads of state and past heads of states and dozens of foreign ministers, defense ministers. And so that's kind of the circle I run in now. And I publish policy papers and columns. I'm a columnist for the Washington Times and Fox News. And so I do quite a bit of speaking tours. So that's why I'll be doing that. In addition to that, my consulting firm is J.D. Gordon Communications, and that consults for think tank clients. And so since I left the Pentagon and retired as a commander in the end of 2009, I've had 8 different think tanks and foundation clients, and the political clients like I've had as well, as you mentioned in the intro, Sarah Palin and Herman Cain. And I also own and operate a super PAC, which is called Protect America Today, and we've been running ads in 8 different states for Senate and House candidates, for 16 Senate and House candidates during this cycle. Several hats.
Well, you sound like you have too many hobbies, as my wife would say. That's pretty impressive. It's funny how you pick winter as the time to go to Europe, but that's okay.
You can tell it's not a boondoggle.
Yeah, well, I always thought that they should have those big fleet conferences in Maine in February, and someplace in Nevada in the middle of July, and that would window
You're
out
right.
who really needs to go to them.
You're right.
I think. Are you planning on publishing anything when you come back from the Baltics and Hungary? Because I know it's a very interesting time right now to be over in that part of the country. Especially in the Baltics, I'm a big fan of Estonia. I served with a lot of great Estonian guys who would regale us at the early hours of the morning what it was like to be a Soviet conscript. But really neat.
Right.
The Baltics are a very neat place.
Oh, yeah. I'll definitely be writing some columns about it. And I've got a policy paper coming out entitled Putin's Petrodiplomacy, based on my visit to Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Turkey this summer. I was there for 2 weeks on the lecture circuit. So, I'll be doing another policy report and a whole round of columns. And I'd be happy to send them to you.
Oh, perfect. As we just have about 3 minutes left in the show, during the course of the show, I was thinking about, sometimes people feel the need to go out in front. And I'm talking, your 4 stars, to increase their image, to burnish their reputation. Sometimes you can be seduced by your ego. It's like, oh, look, people want me to talk. But one of the 4 stars held, you can argue, to say, in the highest regard of the last 15 years, was also someone who spent very little time in front of the media. I think when he got burned once with a comment he made on a panel, and after that he went to ground, and he succeeded very well. And I'm speaking of Marine Corps General Mattis. What are some of the lessons you can take from those that decide that they don't want to play the high-profile game? I think Admiral Harry Harris, who's still in uniform, is another example of somebody that's pretty low-key. Is there an argument, he said, to just shut up and do your job?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. If you're pretty vocal like General Mattis is, they sweep you under the carpet, so to speak, and, it doesn't usually end well for him. But, I think he's a hero and a patriot. Harry Harris is on active duty still. He just became the commander of Pacific Command out in PACOM in Hawaii. So I'm happy for him. We served together, of course, when he was at JTF Guantanamo, and I was a Pentagon spokesman, and I visited Guantanamo over 30 times, and many of those were on his watch. So he's a great officer, and I'm happy for him. But I think you're right. If they want to basically get along, they've got to kind of go along with it. But it's a tough position to be in. But some of those jobs, like PACOM, JCS, they're there, and they're going to be there. Those guys could just try to get along as best possible. But if it's a special category like John Kirby has, it's a different animal.
Well, JD, really appreciate you coming on the show. We've got about a little over a minute left, and I wanted to ask you a question about the difference in the services. It seems to me, as my co-host just pointed out, that the Marine flag officers seem to be a little more direct in their speech, shall I say, than people from the other services. Is that a perception just a common to my approach to things, or are they actually schooled differently than some of the other flag officers?
I think you're right. I think Marine general officers are pretty out there. Remember the old commandant of the Marine Corps, Al Gray? I think maybe during the 1980s. He was really a piece of work, too. He definitely wasn't shy about voicing his opinion. So I think you're right. I think the Marines are out there. They want to take that hill, and they don't mind making their opinions known.
Well, thank you very much, JD. It's been a real quick hour. Appreciate you taking time. Do have safe travels. And if you get bored and don't know what to do in Tallinn or in Vienna, then you're not doing it right. There's a lot to keep you in the game. I hope you have a great trip and look forward to see what you have to write.
Sounds great. Thanks, Sal. Thanks, Eagle One. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Please join us again next week, where we're going to be interviewing now-retired Captain Jerry Hendricks, talking strategy and a few other things that come across the transom. Until then, we'll talk to you. Have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.